Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and with me in the studio is my friend and colleague Niklas Sävås. Today we're happy to have Lawrence Anderson on the show. Lawrence is an experienced and thoughtful investor based in Ireland, where he heads his private investment firm Capstrive. Lawrence has also published three books. So Niklas, which one will we speak about?
So today we will discuss Lawrence's latest book, The Compounder's Element, which key message is for investors to take the long road to success and to focus on buying great businesses and to hold on to them for the long term.
And what do you think about the book?
I really like that it's written in a very personal way by an experienced investor, and I think Lawrence is doing a great job of combining real-world examples with more philosophical ideas. And although the book is written from an investor's perspective, I think many of the lessons on how to create value long-term are also valuable for operators.
The Compounder's Element was published in 2024, and we are thrilled to have its author on the show today. Here comes our conversation with Lawrence Anderson. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to Investing by the Books podcast.
Hey, thanks. Looking forward to this.
It's great to have you on. We recently met here in Stockholm for Redeye's Serial Acquirers conference. Where are we reaching you today?
So normally you'd find me in Dublin, Ireland, but at the moment I'm in Malta for a few weeks.
How come?
I'm trying to do a Templeton on it, but I couldn't afford the Bahamas.
Good enough. And to begin, we're curious about how your passion for investing started.
Yeah, so in my early 20s, I was working in Sydney and they were doing a lot of IPOs, a lot of privatizations in particular. And, you know, they wanted to get retail participation. So these were, you know, effectively price to go. And so the trick was really, you know, get an allocation. That was the work, get an allocation. And normally they would have a sort of a minimum and maybe a maximum retail allocation. So, you know, our friends would get together. Sometimes I'd actually lend a bit of money to some of my friends to use their allocation and you'd stag it in the IPO and then you'd sell it immediately. So it was really nothing to do with investing, but it did have kind of, maybe I would say, some of the characteristics where you have this, variable reward and the illusion of control, both of those things being kind of addictive. And, you know, that started the interest in the stock market. And, you know, I work with a lot of guys who work with mining companies. They were doing the swaps, the interest rate swaps for mining companies. That was back in the good old days where if you did an interest rate swap, you could present value the whole P&L. So these guys were getting bonuses and they were, speculating on mining stocks and things like that. And so it sort of started there. My office was near the Australian Stock Exchange. I used to go down at lunchtime looking at tickers, you know, just watching them kind of magically, you know. So I was definitely looking at stocks as tickers, not businesses back then. Anyway, it started there and sort of grew out of that. I was addicted.
Yeah. There, you have many good sayings and what I think is quotes that I will keep in my books for the future. I mean, one is making money in the stock market is intoxicating as it doesn't look like real work. And I think you're spot on, like how you got started in the first place. It looks so easy.
It does. And, you know, and theoretically, I mean, I think it's still the case in many respects in terms of like real work, working on a mine or working in a real business or doing a real job where there's real danger, so it's sort of still the case. But, you know, clearly there's more intellectual work and then there's emotional work that you have to do. But, you know, it's very intoxicating and still is.
And why did you end up being in Australia in the first place?
I followed a girl actually. So at the time I was going out with a girl and she'd already decided to go to Australia. And so we actually got married. So she's with me now. In fact, she's downstairs in this office today. So this is our first day in this office. So like we're coming back to the Malta thing. I don't want to digress too much, but you know, part of it is just an experiment of working in different cities, get a little bit of a different perspective, but try and actually, you know, work and settle into society. And we have two desks downstairs alongside each other. So that's going to be an interesting experiment. But anyway, obviously the trip to Oz was worth it. I, you know, married a good lady and, you know, we're still together, three adult children. So,
wow.
How bad.
Congratulations on that. but now we spoke about like how you got started in investing. Was business something that was spoken about in your family, or was that an interest for you as well? Or
Very much so. So growing up, my dad had a TV shop and we rented TVs, sold TVs. And I was sort of in the business with him from like 8 years of age. I mean, I had no idea about business, but we were always talking about business and making money. So there was kind of a little bit of an obsession with that, you know, so much so that I never watched sport, for example, as a kid, which is, you know, unusual. My dad said he took me to the park once, I kicked the ball and I didn't kick it back, and he said, okay, that's off. He's just not interested. So, you know, we won't be bothering with that. But I learned a lot. You know, I was working in the shop. You know, I remember getting my first wage packets and things like that in an envelope, £2.50 on a Friday, and that felt really good. And so it started there.
And today we will speak about your excellent book, The Compounder's Element. Why did you decide to write the book?
A strange thing happened. I had an original thought, and I said, okay, this is maybe I like kind of want to own this. So if I was to say to you guys, if I was to pick a phrase and see like what name comes to, you know, if a name comes to mind. So if I said to you like Atomic Habits, any name come to mind for you guys?
James Clear, I think.
Okay. Or if I said to you Anti-Fragile.
Nassim Taleb.
If I said to you The Compounder's Element.
Laura Anderson.
Exactly. So, but joking aside, I mean, it started with, I was really asking in the business, you know, what am I solving for? Like, you know, what game are you playing? And I've been asking this like for sort of 30 years, but, you know, more deeply for the last 10. And I think you don't understand a thing until you start to write it down. And I was writing some notes along the way for my investors. And then probably about 2 years ago, I actually had been in the middle of writing another book, which I abandoned. I sort of got this idea, well, solve for what? What are you solving for? And, you know, that's where I guess I concluded that for us, duration is the key. And we'll talk about that later, probably. And so then I said, okay, that's quite interesting. I've been reflecting and thinking about this. You only find out your mistakes and your logic flaws by writing them down. So I think 90% was clarification for me and learning. And, you know, I guess 10% you'd have to say is ego or something like that. You think you've got something useful to say in the world and you're putting out there because, I think there's some degree of ego. George Orwell was asked this, I think, a long time ago, and he said, you either write for ego or to set the record straight. You know, it's one of those two things. I think he had a couple of other ones as well, but they were the two main ones.
And you structured the book in four parts, where you begin by discussing the benefits of taking the slow journey to success, and then go on to discuss how a great business looks. And in the third part, you focus on key risks. And I mean, the fourth part of the book, you end with practical examples. So let's go in a bit to all these parts. And to begin, I want to ask you sort of, what can we learn from the animal kingdom in terms of taking the long road? Because this is something you write about.
Yeah, so I looked at sharks, elephants, and tortoises. And look, a lot of this is just to have fun with concepts and make them a little bit more memorable. So the shark is your IRR chaser. You're looking for high returns and you want them fast, you know. Like, give me high returns and give them to me today, right? And, you know, they want to be in the what I call the IRR Hall of Fame. The elephants are your classic asset gatherers, and, you know, they just want AUM. So, like, they're in the AUM Hall of Fame, that's what they're aiming for. You know, they don't really care about returns or duration or anything like that, but, it's, you know, it's AUMs times fee and optionality on a performance fee. Who wouldn't like that? And then the third type are the tortoises, and they're solving for duration. So when you look at the compounding formula, capital, you know, times one plus R to the N, you know, the elephants are just, you know, just give me a free option on all the capital. The sharks are, you know, letting R do the work, and the tortoises are letting N do the work. And for me, it was sort of a real revelation that if you let N do the work or most of the work, the R almost doesn't matter. Not, of course, it's going to be positive and positive in real terms, but the N will do an enormous amount of the heavy lifting for you. And even more important than that is that it's easier to get a better N than get a better R if you're in the game of survival. And I know there's a little bit of tautology circular reference there, but you know, if I often ask my friends, you want to be a top, you know, top 5% of asset managers? And I'll say, you know, how do you do it? And they'll say, well, you know, earn 15%, earn 20% or whatever. I said, no, just survive 20 years. Yeah. And you'll be there. And I think it's easier to survive 20 years. And I'm not trivializing surviving for 20 years, but I think that's easier if you go about it in a particular disciplined way than it is to, you know, compound capital 15 or 20% for, you know, a very long period. And look, some people do it, but that's exceptionally hard. And I prefer easier games.
When did you realize this? Because I mean, you started in a different fashion in the industry, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it's probably only about 2 years ago. And I mean, I think this is the insane thing about this craft. Like, you can be at it a long time. And, you know, I mentioned a thing in the book called, you know, the vicarious visceral gap. And, you know, I had all this vicarious learning, you know, in my 20s, read everything. But until you're actually putting your hand in the wound and making mistakes and losing money and observing and reflecting on those observations, there's a huge gap. You know, it's just, they're not even close. And I think it's the fun part about this. And even, you know, even in recent months, there are other things just emerging in how I think, you know, think about this. But this one sort of hit me hard. You know, certain things hit you, like value hits people early on. And then there's the kind of nature of the game. And, you know, someone might say, well, why don't you go for both? Like, you know, high returns and duration. So, well, yeah, like that's, you know, that's cake and eat it and eat somebody else's cake and get them watch you while you eat it or whatever. It's not just not very realistic unless you're brilliant. And I know I'm not brilliant, but not even excellent, you know, maybe somewhere, you know, better than good. And if you can be, and maybe that's an exaggeration, right? Only time will tell. But, you know, better than average, maybe even. And maybe that's an exaggeration. So I have friends now telling me that's, I'm lying here. But you know, there's another phrase I use, which is like the median is the message, you know, not the average. And, you know, the average skews all things. And I want to play a game where the median, the person literally right down the middle, is more likely than not to get a good result. And if you do this activity, you know, 100 times, like in 99 out of 100, you're probably going to get an okay result. And I think the sharks, if they do it 100 times, well, I don't know how many times, but there's, you know, a certain number where you're just taken out of the game. Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, that's back to ergodicity in these things. It's done, you know, the arrow of time is only going one way there. And yeah, it's recent. It's kind of almost embarrassing that it's recent. It's kind of, what was I doing for the first 28 years? But, you know, hopefully I've got another 20 years.
Yeah, and then there's always, like, not one answer for everyone. And you have a good quote from the book that the beauty of the investment industry is that there are multiple paths to prosperity, but only when we match the path to our personality. And I had a discussion with one of our analyst colleagues yesterday about this, like, what does he really mean with this? So what, how do you interpret this?
Yeah, so, and I'd get a small bit philosophical here, guys. So, I mean, essentially we're all on a journey, yeah? And if you can, and you're lucky enough, should be enjoyable. And if I could have took an example, I'd say for I could give you an investment that will give you no return for 10 years. And at the end of year 10, give you a 3x or a 4x. You know, would you take that? And people might, like, intellectually take that. But that journey is absolutely horrible. Yeah. And, you know, but for somebody else, it mightn't be, actually. You know, for somebody who's got a certain degree, a certain type of personality, that might be absolutely fine. You know, I'd say, possibly, you know, a lot of people you know, that would be absolutely fine. I know for me it wouldn't be. I like to get a small bit of feedback along the way that, you know, I'm sort of on the right path. And the other piece of it is, you know, the company you keep. So like a short seller, you're just kind of always in a bad, well, I suspect you're always waiting and wanting bad things to happen. You know, I don't think that's necessarily a good disposition, but for some people it's fine. You know, if you've got an optimistic disposition and you're working with, you know, good companies and good management teams, well, the company you keep during that journey is interesting and you're learning from those people. And look, it gets to public markets versus private markets. What kind of volatility can you live with? A lot of people are, you know, very dismissive of, you know, the par marking of private markets, you know, the volatility laundering, as Cliff Asness calls it. But, you know, for some people, that just allows them to stay the course and, you know, just not get upset by noise. And, you know, in periods like, say, even the last few days, I guess, you know, there's some private market people thinking, ah, fine, you know, nothing to see here. Now, of course, there is something to see here, but they're just not, it's just not right in their face. I'm not sure if that answers it, or I can clarify more. But.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think when you mean the last few days, when we're recording this on April 9th, it's been some turmoil in the market. Before we go on to the second section, I think just explaining the taking the long path and the book's name, The Compounder's Element, if you can just explain what you mean with the title.
Yes, so when it dawned on me that duration was the game to play for me and, you know, my investors and business partners, I said, is there something that I could find as a, you know, a tool to kind of lodge that in my head? And randomly, I don't know, I'm walking or something, I said, you know what, I'll have a look in the periodic table of elements. I like to play with words. So is there something in the periodic table of elements that could be a nice reminder here? And you know, this was long before I wrote the book, and that was kind of part of, again, you know, one of the catalysts to write the book. And I stumbled upon neon. And, you know, neon is atomic number 10, and I'm thinking decades, and 10% is a reasonable annual expected return. But the, you know, the nomenclature for neon is capital N, which I take as maximize duration, and lowercase e, which is minimize errors. Now, it's a very tortured analogy or whatever, but I had actually that element cut out and, you know, stuck on the side of my computer for months before I even thought about kind of writing this book. And, yeah, max, you know, max N, minimize E. But then there is, of course, it also ties into someone being in one's element and about enjoying the journey. Yeah. So, you know, if you're in your element and you're enjoying the journey, I mean, you still may not get the results you want, but enjoying the journey is like 95% of the game, you know? So that just really, really struck me. And look, it's probably obvious, and certainly obvious from you guys and in what you do day to day, but this is an amazingly interesting craft. You know, it's such fun, there's so much learning. And, you know, if at the end, bad luck or stupidity gets you, well, if the journey's been okay, that's fine, you know? But if it's a bad journey, you know, there's no money, there's no money compensates. Yes, that was the spark for that title and thought.
Great. And now let's shift the focus a bit to the second part of the book, where you actually write about what sort of these great businesses that fits your personality right now. And you introduce readers to the concept of structurally advantaged business models. And I think the concept is really similar to moats, but I think you have, and I really like how you have framed these different concepts in a way that makes more sense for you. I can really get that you have written the book, I mean, for yourself, but it's also really fun to read for others. And I think to play with words, as you said, it makes these concepts stick a bit better. So I think that's great.
Can you bring up a few of those examples of business models that you think are superior, and also why you have named them the way you have done?
Sure, and maybe even some history here. So about 3 years ago, I thought I actually might write a book around this concept of structurally advantaged business models, and I gathered everything I could, seven powers and Porter's, four, five forces or whatever it is. I started down that path, and in the end I realized, look, there's something interesting here, but it's certainly not a book, but there's an article or a chapter here. So, again, the reason to start doing this was I was getting sick of, being in bad businesses and waking up to bad news and getting shocks that are no fun. So I said, look, I need to understand what a quality business is about. Okay, so again, if you want to understand, write about it. So I eventually sort of gathered 10 categories, but maybe just to pick two or three. One I called privileged perch. So this is where, you've got a legal or a regulatory advantage. So Moody's, would be a classic example, but testing and certification companies are good examples as well. And no sensible business is going to let a second or third rate testing company, verify the efficacy of a, aerospace part or something like that. Yeah. So that was privileged perch, and you're up there. Some of the other ones would be ones that people would know, and I just tied them into songs, Both Sides Now, which is a scaled two-sided network, Stock on You, which is high switching costs and things like that. But other names that I sort of invented, the ecosystem enabler, which is somebody who enables commerce across an ecosystem, but critically, they don't try and take too much of the profit pool. So they enable 100 and they take no more than 5. Microsoft, I think, would be, a classic example here. Maybe Stripe or someone like that in the private world. And, maybe leading a little bit into your world, I christened a category the high ROIC cookie cutters. And these are companies that can, reinvest capital predictably and consistently reinvest their free cash flows at higher rates of return. And, I think that's a very, very powerful business model as well. So that's just a few of them.
And in that last category that maybe I'm a bit more interested in, and Eddie probably as well, you bring up sort of an expanding supermarket chain and compare that to a serial acquirer. So can you explain the similarities there?
Sure. And look, you guys will know 10 times more about serial acquirers. I knew very little until I attended your conference a couple of weeks ago. But so if you take a supermarket first, the unit economics of a rollout, particularly say in a place like US, in the US, where each of the state, there's reasonably consistent tastes and formats and things like that. So you've got a pretty clear handle on your unit economics, and you've got a long runway. So you think about, Walmart or McDonald's, or Starbucks or any of these, retail concepts. Now, retail has been a graveyard for investors as well, but if you get it right, it's absolutely wonderful. There's a European example called Action, which has been backed by 3i. It's been an absolute thing of beauty, and 18-month payback on stores. And if you've got a good visibility on the white space, and usually they have really, really good data for that white space. So it's quite, I would say it's quite predictable, but retail has its own challenges. In the acquisition world, I don't think it's as necessarily as predictable, or people don't always find it as predictable, but it's no less powerful. And there are plenty of examples of people who have done it, repeatedly. So, in the book, I've mentioned, companies like Roper in the US, and, the market doesn't always give value, to that, because they're saying, well, look, we don't know if they'll be able to continue to do it, but somehow they do. And, a lot of the companies in Sweden and the Nordics, which I hadn't really been following until recently, otherwise a few of them would have been examples in the book, in fact. So this is why, this is so much fun. You're always like, the book is already out of date. There's a bunch of companies up in Sweden that, have shown you can do this, repeatedly and consistently over very, very long periods of time. And I think there, again, it's, there's probably greater discipline needed. Well, sorry, the discipline is always needed, but there's real discipline needed in the price and quality in terms of what people pay. And then it's just one needs to understand, you know, how many potential targets are out there. But yeah, it's very interesting to compare the two, and I think they're both very, very interesting.
I think you know a lot about this model as well, and I don't have too much to add. So let's go into a bit of sort of other concepts, and I mean for listeners who want to learn about all those 10 structurally advantaged business models, they can of course buy the book, which I highly recommend. But in the second part of the book, you also talk about owning cash. And for investors that focus on these sort of long-term compounders, I think many of them don't necessarily have cash in their portfolio. They strive to be fully invested in most times. So how do you think about that?
Yeah, so this is another one that's been evolving for me. And I should say at the outset, so the context is really important. So, you know, a portfolio manager holding cash, you know, versus an individual like any of the three of us holding cash in our personal situations, or indeed a company in which we're invested having some cash. You know, when we look at a company and we like the fact that we have cash. You know, people love the fact that Berkshire is a few hundred billion today. Okay, they love it. Okay, I started out with a lot of cash, and for my first 7 years managing money as a fiduciary, I averaged about 30% cash. And I then asked myself the question, is this a safety blanket, which is cash as optionality and protects you, or is this a comfort blanket that, you know, you always want to have money to, you know, go after your mistakes or double down where you've, you know, been too eager to buy too early? And, you know, I think for me that cash has been a comfort blanket, and the opportunity cost of holding cash is the way to return on your portfolio. You know, there may be times at the extremes to hold cash, but I think a portfolio manager who has been given an equity allocation by an individual, well, that's their fully invested equity allocation. So now, you know, for the last few years, you know, we're fully invested in the, close to fully invested. And, you know, I think it was a mistake to hold so much cash. Now, whether I was wrong in my first 7 years or whether I'm wrong in my latter 3 years, I don't know. It's an evolution. But and the context matters, you know, matters a lot. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
No, I agree. I think it must fit sort of your personality in a way also, that it could give you comfort to be more long-term oriented, I think, to have that sort of security that you have cash in the bank that you could invest if something bad happens. I think you can do that in many different ways, but I think I thought a bit like that in prior years, but have also tilted to become fully invested the longer I've been in the business. Because I think if you buy sort of these high quality businesses, as you say, I mean, a lot of them have net cash themselves, then I may think that why should I keep cash in the bank as well? So I think that's sort of how I think about it.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to what we discussed before we started the recording, and now that the markets are in turmoil and how we deal with the situation. I mean, are we in capital preservation mode, or are we more like net savers and maybe a bit younger and have a long horizon? I think that also impacts how you can think about cash.
Yeah.
And another way in the second part is the barbell approach. And I think that this fits into this context that we discuss now, and it's a concept that, I mean, Nassim Taleb, as we mentioned before, have talked about. So can you talk a bit about the barbell approach and how you have used that in your approach?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Taleb on that. I recently reread Antifragile, and like it was 10 years since I first read it. And I mean, it literally, again, is one of those things that just hits you in the face, like when you read it. And I mean, my notes, like, and slide aside, but it's kind of amusing. Taleb came to Ireland last year. There was a Kilconomics in Kilkenny, sort of, I don't know, a festival of ideas or whatever, but he came, and I went down to see him, and I brought my Antifragile book with me. And I kind of accosted him. He was going to actually see Rory Sutherland, you know, the ad guy, who's really entertaining and very smart, very, very interesting, is good as well. His alchemy book is amazing. But anyway, I had alchemy with me and I had Antifragile with me to get it signed. And no one knows who Talib is down here. Well, not no one, but very few people are taking it. Anyway, so I go up to him and say, look, I have your book. Would you mind signing this for me? I think this is the, you know, best business book I've read. And he just looked at me and said, it's not a business book. Okay. No, I didn't say anything. It was just a thanks, you know, sign it, whatever. But it's just very Talib, you know, like, the, you know, the compliment. And I forgot to ask him. I'd love to say, well, then what is it? But I guess the best book ever is the one that's uncategorizable or something like that. But anyway, that really influenced me. And it also went back to, there's a firm called NZS Capital, Non-Zero Sum Capital. They wrote a paper a long time ago called Complexity Investing. You know, it's probably worth linking into or whatever in your notes, but they talk about, it's a very, very good note, and they talk about the combination of resilience and optionality. And I think that's what a barbell approach is. It's resilience and optionality. So your safe asset is your resilience and your risk asset is the optionality. And I think that's a lot. It's a bit like having senior debt and equity rather than having mezzanine.
Yeah.
And you know, David Swensen's book, Pioneering Portfolio Management, is like a lot, an old book now, but is, you know, very, very interesting in this when he goes through the asset classes and the relative attractiveness of those. And, you know, I think, yeah, so that's, that, you know, maybe that's the, you know, the combination of Talib and the NZS guys. And again, that's a, you know, sort of not quite, it's not so intuitive. I mean, Mez looks like a wonderful thing, you know, but again, it gets to, on when you're solving for duration rather than, you know, something else, I think the barbell approach makes a lot of sense. And by the way, I should mention, I had a friend, we had a book club last week, and I had a friend over who's in the property world, and he only does property. And he said he has a certain amount of unlevered property, and then he has some property that's pretty levered, and he's got maybe, you know, some management fee associated or whatever. He got those two things. And when things get bad, he'll go and just, you know, use the security of his unlevered property. So that's a barbell. Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because his unlevered property is still earning. It's not like cash, which is deflating for you. So anyway, I mean, he was running a barbell approach, and he's a thoughtful guy, so.
And Talib, he did sign the book, or?
Oh, he did, absolutely. Yeah. And he wrote a nice note on it and everything. And look, he could see that I definitely was interested in his book because it was literally destroyed with notes. yeah, so I look at it. I was too kind of awestruck to ask him, well, tell me what kind of a book it is then. And I was afraid I'd get a lecture or something like that. you know, he's brilliant, but he's prickly.
Yeah. He's on our list of potential guests, but we haven't dared asked him yet.
Yeah. Well, look at, yeah. I mean, indirectly, I mean, he has a connection with Ireland and there's somebody, so maybe we'll see. Anyway, watch this space. I can't promise anything. Yeah. He would be a wonderful guest to have on. It'd be fun. It'd be a fun interview for sure.
Yeah, and there are many books to choose from, so.
Yeah.
But let's go into the third section of the book. I mean, the first part we talked about is taking the long path, solving for duration, and the second part is about finding those great businesses and great business models that work for that time period. And in the third part, I mean, we spoke a bit about it now, how you can survive. But in the third part of the book, you write about different ways how you can disrupt compounding, and you write that time is not money, it's exponential money, and that what's not kept can't be compounded. So what are the implications for you when you look at this in your investment process?
Yeah, so this goes back to what I call the miserable math of mistakes. So, you know, everyone knows that you lose 50, it's, you know, it's a double to get even. But I think, and you know, I was guilty of this, it's not just that, it's the other asset that you could have been in that was continuing to compound. Yeah. And then it's also the time and mental, you know, pain and distraction of getting involved in the, you know, when you could have been finding something else that's going to work for you. So the kind of the example I gave is a friend who bemoans his $100,000 mattress. You know, so this is someone who sold some shares to buy a mattress. You know, a small number of shares to buy a mattress, and you know, of course, there's some hindsight bias there. But you know, if you interrupt or dilute compounding, it doesn't look like much in the short term, but when you extrapolate that mistake over 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's an enormous amount. And you know, I was chatting with my business partner about this recently. So, you know, my personal pension, I have some, you know, I've done some venture investing, and you know, a couple of those have gone to zero, and I have had to have a real humdinger of an investment on the other side just to get, you know, 8% a year, right? Now, so you do all the hard work to find a 15%er, and it's completely undone by the mistake. And you know, 15, 20 years down the road, that adds up. And look, that gets the saving early, you know, dollar cost averaging early as well.
And what are other ways to destroy compounding?
Other ways than making mistakes and losing money? Well, I guess you can, I mean, there's tax efficacy, right? So I started in tax, and so you got to keep the gains you make. Yeah. So I started out my career in tax. So I've always been sort of, you know, very tax sensitive in terms of, you know, not looking for tax driven investments, but even looking through to one's investor base, you know, what's their tax position? And a lot of people do not look at that. I mean, you know, Walter Sloss, who had, you know, amazing results. I think the tax result in the hands of his investors was excellent, but not quite as amazing. But is there something else at the question that you're getting at that I'm forgetting that I've written about?
Yeah, I think what many people think about as a common mistake to lose money is leverage, and it's clear. In many parts of your book, it's clear that you have not thought about this, like the first level thinking, but you have done it multiple times, and it's of course from experience, but also I think you're reading a lot. And when it comes to leverage, you have written about several different types of leverage that can kill you or a business. So curious to hear more about those.
Yeah, so you know, everyone's aware of the risk of, you know, debt and, you know, recourse debt and, you know, variable debt and all of that sort of financial debt. And I think of two other, I guess, broad categories of leverage outside of traditional debt. You know, one is off balance sheet leverage, and that would be, you know, things like pensions, derivatives, warranties, JV commitments. And again, I think most of your listeners would be familiar with those. But then I think there's a second category of, you know, hidden leverage. And, you know, in that I would call it like anything that is a tailwind to a business. And, you know, categories here would include, you know, leverage customers or a leverage industry structure, concentrated suppliers, concentrated buyers, the working capital terms in an industry, you know, that can change. So, you know, maybe it's customary for an industry to give 90 days and, you know, there's a bit of a shock and everyone moves to 60 days. Others would include, like, you know, cartel structures or, you know, particular regulatory reliefs. And I mean, you could add maybe a lot of what people have seen in the, you know, green investment landscape as well here. You know, anything that, you know, has really helped that can be taken away is hidden leverage. So, you know, there'd be some of the other ones. And look, there is another category that I talk about as well on the helpful side, which is, you know, friendly financial leverage. And the insurance float in a profitable insurance company is the one that most people would be familiar with. You know, but there are a few there that help as well, where people are getting advantage through their liability structure. You know, but it's very, very rare and hard to get. You know, mostly leverage is a problem, and it reduces optionality, and there's a terrible path dependency with it. And it doesn't just amplify results, because it can't make a bad investment good, but it can make a good investment bad. and you know, there's a real nasty asymmetry there. So, you know, leverage is best avoided.
It's
in all its forms.
It's clear from hearing you now and reading the book and all that you've done a lot of thinking, and it's great that you've put it on paper. And in the fourth part of the book, you discuss events that has happened through your long career. And one thing that got me thinking a lot was that you mentioned that you thought it was a huge difference between managing your own money versus managing money for others. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, I looked at it's literally a difference in kind, I think. Yeah, because I mean, firstly, like the stakes are totally different. You know, what happens to someone's personal capital, it's fine, it's painful or whatever, but it's yours and you can own your mistake and it's fine. But when you're managing as a fiduciary, you know, this is someone's savings. You know, savings is hard work. You know, it's time. They've turned hard work into time, and it's, you know, it's their claim on future time or having a, you know, more choices in the future. So the stakes are, number one, the stakes are higher. I think number two, mistakes are more painful because you can sort of bury your own personal mistakes, put the head down. I mean, you know, how many individuals have you spoke to who've come out of a poker game and, you know, they broke even, you know, everyone seemed to break even, but there's, you know, one guy with all the chips. So, you know, at the personal level, we're all breaking even. Yeah. But you're managing money for other, your mistake is there and it's for everyone to see. And, you know, we don't like to be seen as stupid. Like, it's just no fun. And you look stupid. And you look stupid a lot because, you know, maybe 55-60% of the time you're right, which means, like, you know, 40 or more, you're wrong. You know, you're just wrong. And, you know, when it's private, it's fine. But when it's there in your letter, and again, this drives a crazy behavior, you know, people selling out their, you know, selling out holdings year end because they just don't want to admit they ever owned that horrible thing that, you know, they don't want to be having to explain to people, right? I think the third one, and this is kind of interesting, I've been asking a lot of people about this, is you probably feel that you need to appear a lot more rational when you're managing money for others, you know, on your diligence. So you're probably acting safer and acting maybe less on your gut or your instinct, or doing something that you can't actually quite articulate, but sort of makes sense to you. And there's an interesting follow-up question from this, which I've been asking a lot of friends, and I'd be interested in your guys' thoughts as well, is like, you know, portfolio managers' personal account versus their professional account, which gives the better return? And, you know, so far, you know, everyone I've spoken with have leaned heavily that the personal portfolio is giving a better return. Now, maybe there's a small size thing, maybe there's a, you know, a narrative bias thing going on there, but I suspect there's something deeper in terms of, you know, being willing to, you know, buy at the bottom, admit a mistake early maybe and sell it and just get rid of the damn thing. And I'd say that's a very interesting possible area of study for someone to do, but I don't know what, I'd be interested in what you guys think or seen or
I would assume that the personal account is maybe making is worse off, but then their partners or their children or their other family members, they get the real benefits because there you really don't want to take any risks and really buy at the bottom and so on.
I could guess that maybe, I mean, with the rules being a fund manager, you need to be more diversified than you maybe want to be and so on. Then maybe you concentrate a bit on your best ideas in your personal account. That could be something. But I think you're probably better to answer that as you've been managing money for others and we haven't. So.
Well, definitely there's concentration. There's probably survivorship bias and who you talk to. I think, Eddie, your point about the children or the other person's account is a very good one, and I have actually seen that one firsthand. I have a colleague who, you know, manages money for relatives, and that's the best performing account actually. You know, so maybe that's getting the discipline of care and ambition. I don't know. Anyway, it's another reminder that, you know, managing between for a fiduciary and oneself are not the same thing. And then, of course, for an asset gatherer, it's just another thing altogether. And, you know, they're just, you know, I mean, it's really very, very careless. So the asset gatherers building a business for themselves, and you know, they're delivering some sort of a product for investors, but it's not an investment-driven one.
You touched on the sort of immense responsibility that you have managing money for others, and I mean, as we speak right now, as we mentioned, there is quite a market turmoil going on. So how do you advise sort of asset managers to cope with this situation?
Yeah, so look, I've probably had maybe been through about 4 or 5 of these. You know, the last one was COVID, and in fact, you know, I in the book I put an extract of literally my letter to investors in the middle of COVID, and you know, that time was far more distressing because I think there was a lot more sort of uncertainty out there. But essentially you're re-underwriting your portfolio and asking the question, you know, what's changed, and does everything still make sense? Yeah. I think in an environment like this, and I'm not a macroeconomics guy, I always have the phrase macro for context, micro for conviction. You know, you get your conviction from the micro. Now, this is a major macro change. The cost of the cost of capital, I think, has gone up. The cost of equity has gone up. You know, profit margins are probably coming down. So stocks should be down. And then it's a question of quantum. Are you leveraged? Are you going to be caught in some kind of crossfire? You know, are your companies operating within their own borders, they operating across borders, all those kind of things, you know? But ultimately, a big one is leverage. Yeah, you know, are your companies leveraged? Are you levered? And you just re-underwrite. And you know, previously, you'd be saying, "Well, this is a nice time to have cash," and you're, you know, adding some more cash. If you don't, then you're just looking across your portfolio, saying, you're judiciously rebalancing. You know, are there some things here where the change is disproportionate, or is it just simply an indiscriminate sell-off? And if it's an indiscriminate sell-off, that, you know, got to suck it up and you know, stay on it and hold a course. You know, it's that's always been the case. Hold a course. But I don't, you know, I don't have advice for others. All we're doing is just looking at our portfolio. Is everything that we thought, are all the reasons that we're invested still valid, and has something changed? And you just ask that question. What I love to have in these situations are CEOs in companies that understand, you know, the optionality of the moment, and they're doing the hard work, you know. And I think if you've got good management teams that have businesses with this combination of optionality and resilience, you know, this is the time where they make it. So I would, you know, I'm fundamentally a lazy person. I would rather the CEOs of our companies be doing that work. And you know, we have a couple and they're doing that and they're buying back a lot of stock.
And related to this, in the book you write that over time you have gravitated towards investing in liquid public companies and less of those VC investments, which you mentioned many went to zero. Why have you done this transition?
Yeah, so I've never been doing an awful lot of private, so it's not necessarily a transition, but it's an increasing preference. You know, the first one is go back to the point of sort of laziness. Like with a public company, you can just buy the stock. You don't have to get into all the legals and lawfare and, you know, emotional turmoil that comes with negotiating documents. The bigger one, I guess, is the continuous optionality that you get from public stocks, right? So, and that optionality is not only available to you as an investor, it's also available to the management team of a company. So, you know, a good management team, you know, and I mentioned we've a couple of companies right now where the CEOs are buying back stock. And I mean, that's the closest thing to an informational advantage, an actionable informational advantage that you will get. Now, you need a good capital allocator at the helm, and the history of stock buybacks, as you know, is not great in aggregate, but for those who really know what they're doing, it's an incredible tool. The other reason I like public securities is you can scurry out of your mistakes, like with your head still on your shoulders, like you're not getting your head handed to you. And, you know, coming back to the private examples, I had one private, I shouldn't be laughing. I had one private company that like went to a 10x, and I knew it was sort of nuts, and I kept offering it back to them and other shareholders at 8x, 5x, 3x, you know, But no, there was nobody taking it back, even though they did a fund, the most recent raise at 10x, and it was still a zero at the end. Like, you know, in a public company, you know, you've options along the way, and if you've made a mistake, hopefully it's not a cliff risk. You know, depending on the company and the work you've done, usually it's not a cliff risk. Usually there are some signs there, and you don't have to make the money back the way you lost it. Yeah, and I say, you know, you get 30,000 new choices every day, or 20,000 new choices every day. Now that's maybe the tyranny of too much choice, but you also get a new choice every day on your own portfolio. And fundamentally, it comes to, do you see this, you know, it's the instruct versus serve analogy. Is the market instructing you or serving you? You know, do you see this as cheap, free optionality, or is it beating you around the place? And again, I think that's back to disposition a little bit. And I'm happy enough to take that, you know, what I call the daily capricious score in return for the free optionality. Now, in, you know, in days like the few, last few days, it doesn't feel like an awful lot of fun. And, you know, some of it is not just a capricious score. Some of it is actually a genuine repricing of risk. You know, things are genuinely less valuable to varying degrees, and the question is to how much. But, you know, that's, you guys talked about the price of admission earlier. That's the price of admission to be in something that is literally a river of free optionality. And I think if your company CEOs are also highly attuned to that optionality, that's a wonderful combination.
Do you still see any benefits investing in private companies?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, there are two bigger ones. I guess one is you do stay the course. So if you happen to have got it right, you're not going to get shaken out. You'll stay the course. I think the other one is, if you've got a board seat or a substantial majority position, you know what's going on. I mean, we really have no idea what's going on in public companies. So, well, sorry, I would have no idea. I mean, you know, we're a small, modest investor. I mean, sorry, you've patterns, and you know, you've base rates, and you've things to work with. But, you know, in the kitchen, yeah, you're not getting into the kitchen, right? You can't see, you know, how clean the fridge is. Okay, in a private company, I think you can, to a larger degree. I think if you're a passive minority in a private company, that's, again, a totally different, and there's all various degrees here. It's just a totally different world, not great. So I think they're two of the big ones. And I guess there's a theoretical one. I'd like to see the analysis of this. I haven't seen it, but, you know, there should be an illiquidity premium for privates. So in theory, you should earn more from the privates. But again, getting out of mistakes, see optionality, and, you know, people have this idea of traders and investors. Yeah. So like Market Wizards, you know, Schwager's Market Wizards. I mean, you know, some of these traders were the best investors of all time, right? Totally different game. And then we assume we've got traders, and we assume we've got investors over here. I mentioned a firm, I don't know them personally, but I followed their work. Canadian firm called Turtle Creek, you know, and they're quite good at harvesting the price volatility within their listed portfolio. And they actually, you know, track it. And, you know, it's a couple of points per year difference from leaning in or leaning out. And, you know, different people's tax circumstances may or may not enable that. But, you know, this is where I think these comparisons can be so fraught. And, you know, a lot of people are saying that the best private companies are staying private longer, and no one wants to be public because of all of the scrutiny. And I understand that. And, and by the way, I had another thought. Sorry for wandering off here, but it's your guy's fault. Is coming into this, I'm thinking, you know what? The serial acquirers are probably an interesting combination of both. You have a public company, and they're harvesting the private illiquidity premium. Yeah. So that's kind of a nice mix there. Yeah.
Fully agree on that. But we spoke about your role as an investor, but we haven't talked so much about your private investment firm, CapStrive. So it would be interesting to hear a bit more about the background of this, how it's set up, the structure, and so on.
Yeah. So we're just into our 10th year now in CapStrive. Before CapStrive, I was working in a Dublin-based private investment firm that a colleague set up from scratch, built to $8 billion of AUM. And I was in their managing a small value fund for partners in the firm and a few friends. We actually started on the, this point is only just come back to me now, on the 12th of December 2012 with 12 investors.
Right.
And anyway, 12 is a kind of an interesting number. If you could do 12% for 12 years, you'd be in a nice place and then do it again. So anyway, did that. KKR bought this firm, Dublin-based firm, and I was in there for about a year before they noticed, before they got around to me and said, what's this tiny thing doing in here? They were closing down larger funds for lack of scale. So I took it private at that point. It was a fund, a regulated fund at that point, and but I didn't want all that sort of hassle of fund regulation. So Capstribe is a firm, a corporate, in the active trade of financial securities and the long-term holding of private investments. It's set up with a handful of investors, essentially three families and my own savings. And the idea is to preserve and protect intergenerational wealth and maybe hopefully proliferate that intergenerational wealth over time. So, you know, we're not looking to raise money or anything like that. It's just, you know, managing compound capital in a sensible and long-term and also tax-efficient way.
And how do you operate this practically on a day-to-day basis?
What do you mean by operate it practically?
Running the fund, like how are your days structured?
How's my day structured? Yeah, it's very boring. Like I just, you know, come into the office. I should add that like for the first 7 years, it was entirely me on my own. And more recently, you know, one of the investors actually has come out of retirement and like he's an absolute brilliant financier and, you know, he's the guy that built the asset management firm. He knows this world inside out. And anyway, he's younger than me and sort of coaxed him out of retirement. So anyway, so we've two rooms alongside each other, but they're like closed doors. And, you know, we each come in, we put our heads down and we're sort of reading all day, but it's terribly boring. I mean, the office is about, it's an hour from my house on the train, but it's like 2 hours of walk. So sometimes I walk and I get up early, like 7 a.m. I'll actually walk to the office. I'll put on a podcast. I've been listening to all of yours, by the way. And I should say a shout out to David Henry, who introduced us, because I'd never heard of your podcast. And I've nearly listened to all the episodes now. You guys have been accompanying me on a lot of my morning walks. So I walk into the office and, you know, we've only like 15 stocks between us. You know, we actually divided the public portfolio in two. So this is how we did it. I run half it. Alan runs the other half. And the privates do their thing. And as money comes back, that comes into the public portfolio. Or if we want to do a private, we finance it out of the public portfolio. So that gives us both the autonomy around. Now, our investors don't know who owns what stock. They just get the blended stuff. But Alan and I have autonomy, but we have the beauty of being able to compare notes and, you know, talk and say, listen, what do you think of this? Is this nuts? Is that not nuts? I mean, maybe it gets back to the thing. It doesn't feel like work or look like work or whatever.
How many holdings do you have in the portfolio, and what are your thoughts on the sizing of those?
Yeah, so we've on the public side, we've 15 or 16, 16. So we've 15. We added another one last Thursday. So I think 16 now. But the public side is about half, a little over half the overall portfolio. So in a sense, you know, that 16 might be 32 in a kind of position size sense. So we've got nothing on the public side more than a 4 or 5 position right now. I've had 15% positions in the past. We've also seeded another fund manager, you know, with capital. So we've got ourselves and his previous employer where he's sort of first check and he's out doing his own thing. So, you know, he's probably got 20 stocks. So there's an element of diversification over there. And, you know, we've also, you know, taken a small stake in his asset management firm. We don't do that as a business, but we've known this guy, you know, for a very, very long time. I think he's amazing. And it's just really interesting to be on the journey with him as well. I think as time goes on, I'm more respectful of diversification as time goes on. Concentration is, I say it's an act of ambition and an act of arrogance. You know, it's ambitious towards returns, but it's a kind of an arrogant act. And there's a huge survivorship bias in all the concentrators. And I say there's also a brilliance bias. You know, some people are genuinely, they really, really know their stuff, and there's a brilliance there. Druckenmiller called himself an idiot savant. And I just say, I'm an idiot full stop. So, you know, if diversification is sort of some protection against ignorance, that's, you know, that's fine. And there's another quirk on this as well. Like when we look at, or when people look at investment, their companies in which they're invested, they want those companies to be incredibly diversified by customer, by client, you know, by business line, by supplier, you name it. And yet, you know, you flip your head and you're saying, oh, concentration is the way to go. Yeah. So anyway, I think that's an interesting one. And again, that also gets down to, personality for people as well. You know, you can go Schlosser, you can go Munger, you know, or anywhere in between.
Yeah. And then some of those, I mean, the serial acquirers that we mentioned, some of them have hundreds of holdings of private companies within them. Then you kind of own a fund already. So.
Correct. And you can concentrate on one of those, no problem. But, you know, they don't believe in concentration, you know, and they're, I guess, obviating perhaps a portfolio manager's need for concentration. I mean, another way I look at this is, you know, if, almost like hiring people into your firm, like the management teams, if you get really, really good management teams and, you know, you buy the stock, you're sort of hiring the person. Well, like, if you can get a great person at a reasonable price, like, why wouldn't you take them? You know, so people have heard of GARP, you know, growth at a reasonable price. You know, I'm playing around at the moment with MARP, which is management at a reasonable price. And you know, you can get, you know, I mean, there's a few in Ireland, CEOs, amazing, and, you know, reasonable prices. And they've shown in times of crisis, I mean, they're busy at the moment, for sure. And if history is any guide, they're busy doing accretive things. So if you could have more of those, why wouldn't you?
It's been great to hear sort of your thoughts about the book and your thoughts as an investor. And now we want to talk a bit more about you as an author and the writer. So this is the third book you have written, and one of your earlier titles is a really fascinating book that I read a few years back, which is called The Pebbles of Perception, where you discuss mental models. It was sort of a concept that really got me hooked into reading more and learning, and so I want to thank you for that. Could you please sort of summarize the book in a minute or two?
Yeah, so the subtext of the book is how a few good choices, Pebbles of Perception, how a few good choices make all the difference. And I think it's in the subtext that the message of the book is. So there are a few things in your life that we all do that are very consequential. You know, like consequential decisions that make a huge difference in our life. And these are things like, you know, where to work, whom to marry, whether to have children, where to live. So I explore all of those, and they're big decisions. If you get them right, you know, and you know, we mentioned at the start of this, my trip to Sydney, you know, it makes a big difference. And then there are also certain skills that I think are disproportionately valuable. So I do some work on like sales and negotiation in there, listening, and you know, even kindness, so look, it's a collection of important decisions and useful skills. And you know, that was inspired by Munger, you know, the almanac or whatever, and you know, that had been sitting on my shelf for a long time. So anyway, that's where Pebbles of Perception came out of. I'm glad you read it, thank you. It's nice that you did. And that's actually 10 years ago now. So I wrote that when I was in KKR, and it's actually quite funny because no one knew. I just wrote the thing, and I mean, it's self-published, right? We put it out there. And then it was going around, and people were saying, you have an unusual surname, but I didn't realize there was other Lawrence Andersons out there, you know? And, you know, a few days later, people said, actually, Lara actually wrote that. So it's kind of funny, you know.
And do you want to write more books going forward?
The bar is insane now. Like, there's just so much coming out. I think the topic would have to be incredibly interesting to me, and I think I'd feel I'd have to be adding something to what's out there, and like everything's out there almost. So it's a high bar, never say never. You know, I have a few that I've abandoned, you know, have done a lot and I've looked back at them and said, you know what, there's just not enough interesting here. I try to be very respectful of people's time. Like, to read a book is an act of, you know, devotion of time. And, you know, a lot of books really should be articles. So, for example, the structurally advantaged business model chapter in there, a few people have said to me, you should turn that into a book. And like, it doesn't need to be a book, you know. So I don't know. It's I'd say unlikely for a long while, unless some spark of serendipitous spark of uniqueness comes out of nowhere. I'd say keep me quiet for a while.
We'll keep our eyes open for your name. But is there any book that you would like to read but not write yourself?
So this comes back to something we were chatting about earlier about management. I'd love to see a book, maybe call it like The Contenders, 100 public company CEOs, you know, from all over the world, different markets, that have shown competence in, you know, capital allocation, know their business, are fair and transparent, you know, write clearly. You know, we have the outsiders, but it was a handful of people that was looking back. There's a couple on The Intelligent Fanatics, again, a handful, but like, they are out there. I mean, I can count 4 or 5 in Ireland alone that, you know, meet those chops. And, you know, I think any investor, me included, would love someone to take that project on. I don't think it's a very, very difficult project. I mean, I think you could tell an awful lot from just reading the annual letters of a CEO as to, you know, what they're made of. Occasionally you'll get a false positive where someone's talking the talk, but they're not, you know, they actually don't have it. But, you know, I'd say eight times out of 10, you know it when you see it. And I just haven't combed enough people. But that's an ongoing project for me now in my investment agenda. And, you know, so if someone would write that, count me a buyer. And, you know, if there's 100 CEOs in there, they're going to sell at least 100 copies.
Great idea. Lawrence Anderson, thank you so much for coming on Investing by the Books podcast to talk about you and your great book, The Compounder's Element. Do you have something more you want to add here before we finish up?
No, just to say thanks. And, you know, thanks for the preparation. I mean, your enthusiasm, your questions. I think you've made the Investing by the Books your own version of a high ROIC learning cookie cutter. So well done. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you for those words. It's an honor to have you on. And lastly, where can our audience follow you and your work and buy your books?
Yeah, so you just go to enderson.com, all E's, E-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. And if that doesn't work and you misspell my name, just search The Compounder's Element and hopefully it finds me.
Perfect. We'll put that in the show notes. Thank you so much, Lar.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Lar.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Red Eye. Follow us on Twitter at @ib_redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.